TalkZone presents Money at Work, the weekly show that addresses the issues of the day from a financial perspective. Now, here are your hosts, Steve Memory and Brian Bourdon.
Thank you and welcome. You know, they always say Steve Memory and Brian Bourdon, and I'm always the first one to talk. This is Brian Bourdon. Well. Welcome to this Thursday, February 6, 2014 edition of Money at Work. Originating from TalkZone.com in Chicago, we're broadcasting live from Old Town Alexandria, Virginia, from the office of OV Capital Management. We're a registered investment advisory in the state of Virginia and subject to all the rules and regulations governing RIAs in the Commonwealth. We're going to set up today's program right now. I'm going to be joined shortly, as always, by my partner, Steve Memory, my co-host. He'll be looking at the major indices for us, and he's going to give us a brief synopsis of what's been going on, you know, with all the volatility we've witnessed early on here in 2014. And then we're going to be joined again today, as we were last week, by our CFP and emerging markets analyst, Lily Poy. Lily's going to be talking to us, taking a look at activities in the emerging markets and how that all shapes up and what that means to investors. And then we're going to get into a little bit of detail on exchange-traded funds, commonly known as ETFs, what those are and how they can work in your portfolio. But first, as we get going, as I promised at the top, I'm going to bring Steve in here to talk about, you know, what's going on. It's been a really interesting past week, and as we start today, we'll take a look at the major indices we always look at, starting with the Dow, that's sitting at about 15,579 right now, up about 138 points. It had crossed 15,6 earlier today. The S&P at 1768, that's up about 16 points. And the NASDAQ's up about 38 at 4,050. So the NASDAQ's still holding strong, well over 4,000. So, Steve, that's what, I'm just spitting numbers out at you right now, but we've seen a lot of volatility, not only at the beginning of the year, but in the last week, it's really been a roller coaster ride. So why don't you weigh in on that for us?
Yeah, actually, it's we've had quite a bit of volatility, particularly through January. That's when most of our volatility took place. It's kind of an interesting thing. You know, we'll get into a little bit of detail on this a little later on. We kind of take a look at where we are in the marketplace and our case for and against a market bottom here. But if you take a look at the straight out graph on even like a Google Finance or anything like that, if you're sitting in front of your computer and you want to pull it up, it's kind of interesting. You see, we had kind of a bit of a sleigh ride there downhill from about the 15th or so of January right up through this past Monday. We had some numbers come out. Taking a look at manufacturing data. Like I said, we'll go ahead and get into this a little bit more. But yeah, the volatility that's out there, it's, you know, it's fairly substantial. If you're playing volatility, this was a good time for you. For the rest of us who just want to go ahead and see nice consistent growth in our portfolio, it's been a cause for some reflection, a bit of an opportunity to take a look and see where your portfolio is and whether or not you're where you need to be. And that, I guess, a little bit about how we're going to be talking with Lily Poy coming back here. It's always nice to have her on the radio program with us.
Yeah, we got a lot of positive feedback on Lily last week, so we thought, hey, let's go back to that well. And I'm going to bring Lily on right now. And Lily, let me just say to you, Hung Hei Fat Choi.
Gee, Brian, I didn't know you can speak Chinese. Kong Hei Fat Choi to you too.
I either just ordered lunch or wish you a happy new year.
I think he had a Chinese fortune cookie in his back pocket. I don't buy it.
Well, we've got Lily here with us and Lily,
by the way, sorry to interject here. What exactly does that mean anyway?
Oh, Kong Hei Fat Choi means, you know, Chinese people always like wealth and fortune.
Okay.
And
that's everybody.
Right. It just basically means I wish you fortune and wealth.
Ah, okay. Well, good.
Extend that to the old listening audience here. But Lily's going to talk to us today. She's our certified financial planner, but she's also an analyst here. She analyzes emerging markets for us here at OV Capital. And everything gets segmented off, you know, when you're talking about investments. Is it international? Is it global? You know, international are exactly what they sound like. They're international investments from other countries. Global would be international, but since it's global, it would also take in domestic. And while not all international investments are emerging markets, all emerging markets are international. So Lily, why don't you start off by telling us how you define the emerging markets? And let's start with that. What makes an emerging market?
Sure. I don't want to sound like a book, but I just want to be as factual as I can. Emerging markets define. Okay, the term emerging markets and developing countries are sometimes used interchangeably. But generally, emerging markets are countries that are experiencing rapid economic growth and financial and economic liberalization prompted by policy reforms. Typically, they have immature capital markets and only partial developed institutions. And a lot of time, these countries are going through rapid economic, political, and social transformation. And generally, the per capita income and gross national income, GNI, of emerging market are just a fraction of those of the developed world economies. The World Bank classified countries into four income categories: low income, lower middle income, upper middle income, and high income. The majority of emerging countries fall between the bottom three categories and have a GNI per capita income of below 12,000, roughly. And by comparison, the U.S. GNI per capita is about $50,000.
Okay, out of the universe of investments that we have to choose from out there, domestic, international, BRICS, you know, Brazil, Russia, India, China, things like that, what percentage of the overall market is made up by emerging market investments?
Let me put this into perspective, okay? According to my latest reading, the global market, I'm talking just purely on equity market. Probably as of December 2013 is about $40,952,000,000,000. So that's a global market that includes the United States, developing and emerging. And the U.S. is roughly 50% in weight. And the emerging market is about 10.72% in weight. So that just give you like a little bit of perspective on how, what emerging market is in relation to the global market.
Give me an example of a player in the emerging markets. Tell me about a country that's in the emerging markets that, and you know, and what that means for us.
Okay. I would say, you know, they actually divide into four areas: it's Asia Pacific, Europe, Latin America, Middle East, and Africa. And China actually is like 30% of the weight. So, you know, when you think about the emerging market, you know, we often think about China, Taiwan, India, Indonesia, Malaysia, Thailand, and Philippines.
Now that's interesting because China, you know, we hear about China as this economic powerhouse, this evolving economic powerhouse, and here they are qualified as an emerging market.
Yeah, and I guess the most recent news that you hear about China is they recently came up with a PMI index was pretty weak. And so, you know, some people attribute to the recent global sell-off to the weak PMI number from China.
Okay, what is the PMI index?
Purchasing Manager Index.
Okay. I just want to get out there for everybody who might not know what that is. Steve, you look like you wanted to weigh in on this.
Well, I just had a question. When you say that's 40% or 30% of the index, is that, I guess you may have answered the question actually, but is that 30% of the Asia Pacific index is made up of China, or is that 30% of the overall emerging markets?
Actually, that's a good question. It's actually the index itself, not the whole, it's the emerging market index. It's almost 30%.
Okay, so the emerging market index as a whole, not just the region of the Asia Pacific region, as you broke that
right
out.
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And
Lily, how
way,
have no?
Oh,
go ahead. Lily, finish your thought.
Oh,
I was just
going to
ask
people,
you how have the emerging markets fared in comparison, let's say, to other investments that are out there? I mean, other investments in portfolio being, you know, domestic, global, international, things like that. How have the emerging markets fared over the course? How'd they do in 2013?
Okay, last year they actually did very poorly, you know, along with the REITs. You know, they're in the bottom. If you ever look at the periodic table of asset class returns. But if you want to think about, I guess, on a long-term basis, the cumulative return for the S&P 500 over 10 years is 104%. But the emerging market performed much better with a return of about 198%. And granted, much of the gains come from the years before the global financial crisis. And that was when the commodity prices soared, boosting many emerging markets.
There's a lot more volatility involved with the emerging markets, isn't there? There's an unpredictability factor with those, because there's one thing about emerging markets that you don't have domestically, or seldom have domestically, is I guess what we call political risk. You don't have to worry about someone being overthrown in United States, Great Britain, Canada, someplace like that, where, you know, you get to some of the countries that are in South America and, you know, this emerging market's doing well, but oh, there was a coup, so your investments have taken a hit.
Isn't New Jersey in the process of overthrowing Christie right about now?
Well, actually, you know, you talk about risk. You know, there are three very distinct risks when you invest in emerging market. On top of my head, I think about the lack of information standards within the country or the region, and the risk of the currency of the stock exchange where the investment is located may depreciate against the U.S. dollar. And then, of course, you know, the political risk associated, you know, with the, like, the dark side of emerging market.
Okay, so you're saying then that the regulation isn't as strict there, so they're not held to the same, say, high standards that we're used to dealing with here.
Let's just say that they operate business in a little bit different than the U.S. And granted, they're putting a lot of, you know, very good control in place.
One hand in your pocket, one hand in someone else's pocket. Is that it?
Well,
Lily, you touched on something just a second ago. You were talking about, you know, the dollar movement. What kind of effect does the exchange rate have on emerging markets and the investments they're in?
Let's see. Well, the effect of currency movement on foreign investment always matter. In general, if the value of the U.S. dollar goes up compared with a foreign currency, an investment traded in that foreign currency will go down in value because it will be worth less fewer dollars. And this can have a negative effect on your investment performance. Now, conversely, when the U.S. dollar is weak in relation to the foreign currency, an investment traded in that foreign currency will increase in value.
Okay, so if we're keeping score at home, we would say it has a negative correlation. Dollar strengthens, your emerging market assets are going to weaken. Dollar weakens, your emerging market investments are going to strengthen.
Inverse correlation,
yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think if you plot the appreciation of U.S. dollar and looking at the emerging market, you can kind of see it visually, you know, how they relate to each other.
Yeah.
Okay, who should invest in these? And Steve, probably throw this your way. I mean, these are fairly, they're volatile investments. I mean, they're risky. So,
but that's not, you know, as part of a diversified portfolio, risk isn't necessarily something we need to go ahead and back away from entirely. What it does mean is we need to go ahead and make sure it's part of a diversified portfolio. You need to speak with your financial advisor about this and make sure that you're adequately balanced. Going ahead and putting all of your money into emerging markets obviously is going to be very risky. Sure, you could pay off, but you also have the great possibility that you're going to see some significant down cycles. And that's why when we go ahead and build an allocation, we usually keep that for a smaller percentage of most portfolios, just because most people don't have the risk tolerance to go ahead and allow them to stick a large quantity of their overall portfolio into the emerging markets.
And Lily, we're kind of coming up against the break here. What I want to ask you about is the best way to invest in emerging markets for someone who might want to get into that.
Do you want to talk about it now or when we return from the station break?
Well, I think what we're going to do is we're going to get into the ETF factor. So I thought we'd get into that on the other side of the break. I just wanted to prep you for that and our listeners too, because we're going to get into not only how to invest in emerging markets, but the vehicle used to do that and break that down a little further. So we'll be back on the other side of the break. You're listening to Money at Work at TalkZone.com.
Welcome back to Money at Work on TalkZone. Here's Steve Memory and Brian Bourdon.
Thank you. Brian Bourdon back with you, along with Steve Memory and Lily Poy. It is Thursday, February 6th, 2014. We're coming to you from our office in Old Town Alexandria, OV Capital Management. Lily's out in Fairfax. Wanted to let you know, remind you, that if you want to get a message into us, if you'd like to get a question answered on the air, send it to mail@ovcapital.net. We'll get that on for you and we'll take a look. Before we went to break, we were talking about the emerging markets, what they are, how they operate, what percentage of investments they are, and who should invest in them. And really, as Steve was saying, really anybody can. I mean, even if you're a fairly conservative investor, a small part of your portfolio can at least, and maybe should, hold some emerging markets in them. And what we wanted to find out was, well, what's the best way to do that? Because, you know, not everybody has enough time to sit down and analyze foreign markets, emerging markets, that kind of thing. So, Lily, we had touched on ETFs. So ETFs probably being the best way to get into emerging markets for someone listening. What are ETFs and how do they work? How can people get involved in those?
Well, ETFs certainly have grown. ETFs stand for exchange-traded funds. And as of now, I think in the U.S. we have over $1.7 trillion of asset under management by ETFs, by exchange-traded funds. And I remember when I first start tracking them, they had $500 billion, and this is back in like 2005. Mm. And they certainly have grown a lot. ETFs, I guess just think of them as a basket of stocks, and they are tied to an index. And, you know, like everybody talk about the Dow, the S&P, the NASDAQ, those are all index. And so when you buy an ETF, you're buying a basket of stock. And so you have exposure to certain thing that you wanted to be involved in.
Okay, so I could get a pharmaceutical ETF. I could get an ETF that's in energy or in industrials, things like that.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. A long time ago, you can only do the broad market or the style, but now it is like they have so many. You can go into different countries, different sectors. You know, they have a lot of like the beta or factor, you know, type, you know, more exotic ETFs. But just for our discussion today, you can certainly use ETF so that you can have exposure to emerging market.
Hey, Lily, just a question here. I know that there are the index-based exchange-traded funds, but am I right in saying that there are also certain exchange-traded funds that are based upon an investment style and essentially have a manager, much like regular mutual funds, many of the managed mutual funds?
Yes, yes.
Because I know they can I guess there's a few different fund managers out there that are associated with a particular technological or a technical analysis style, and some of them, you know, actually manage money under those auspices. Never actually use them, but I know they're out there.
Lily, what I'd like you to do is I'd like you to draw kind of a comparison between ETFs, exchange traded funds, and mutual funds, because as you said at the beginning, ETFs are a basket of equities. They're a basket of stocks. Mutual funds are kind of sold the same way. But there are some really distinct and pointed differences between a mutual fund and an ETF. And I'd like you to cover those if you would.
Sure. Well, we know that they are, you know, they're basically the same as far as they hold a basket of equities. The difference is a mutual fund is being actively managed by a manager or a group of managers. Now, the difference is the exchange-traded fund, you can trade all day long. It's very transparent. You actually know exactly what's in the ETF. and the price fluctuate on a minute-to-minute basis.
So you can buy it just like you would buy a regular stock then?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, so the advantages of that then, too, would be not having mutual funds. You buy B-shares, you have surrender charges going out, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years if you want to break out of this mutual fund, or you have front-end loads, you know, back-end loads and such things. And an ETF trades what we call intraday. So you want to get out of it at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. You can get out of it at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. You're not waiting for the end of the day to see what price you got.
And yes. So you're not getting that 4 or 5% front-end load on it as well. Is that right?
Right, right. You always look at the expense ratio when you invest in ETFs. Is very clearly stated in their fact sheet. And I think in general, they are like less than 0.50%.
Really? How does that compare to a mutual fund?
Comparing to a mutual fund, I would say most of the good mutual fund would charge you probably 1, 2, 3% or higher.
A long time ago, I think I read somewhere Fidelity did a study. Now I'm just going ahead and pulling this out of my brain. And this was when I was in the wirehouse. So that was the early part of the new millennium. But I recall a study that was done that estimated the overall percentage rate that people paid on a mutual fund. And now this includes the no-load mutual funds that are out there as well. But they said the average amount that was paid was about 2%. So even some of the hidden charges, I guess, through commission costs that weren't necessarily line items on a no-load fund were one of those things that went into the overall expense of an exchange-traded, or not exchange-traded fund, but an index fund or a mutual fund. And 2% is fairly substantial.
It's huge. I mean, you're looking at 12b-1 that contains all of the marketing costs that go into a mutual fund as they continue to market the product, to get it out there, to get people to move in and out of it. And those are things that you're not necessarily dealing with an exchange-traded fund. I mean, you've got to pay your advisor, your broker, whomever, whatever you pay them to get in and out of it, but there's not a whole lot of, you know, piggyback fees and expenses involved with it.
Yeah. Now, I know in a regular mutual fund, an international or a small cap fund generally has a much higher expense ratio than, say, a fixed income or a large cap value fund. Is that the same thing, Lily, in exchange traded funds? I mean, does that pretty much hold true?
Yeah, pretty much, because if you just buy, let's say, the S&P, a spider, or the Dow Jones, you know, you just want to buy into the market, and those expense ratio is just like really low because it doesn't really require a lot of work. Depending on the methodology of the index, you know, some are full replication of the index, some are representation, and some are just synthetic. And as far as country fund, it does require a lot more work. So therefore, the expense ratio is going to be higher.
Yeah, because you have to translate everything into English first, right?
Yes. And you
now,
do
I
need to have a high
spider.
Level of sophistication, you know, to do country funds.
I was laughing that you brought up the old spider. The reason they call it the spider, of course, is it's the S&P 500. The symbol on that was SPY. Mm-hmm. And so spy, and they went spider. And that back, I guess, came out in what, 95, 97, something like that?
93, yeah.
Was that that early even? I just remember starting to take a look at them in the mid-90s. And because it was one of the few option strategies that the government allowed you to do inside an IRA, interestingly enough. This is just trivia I'm throwing out here.
I didn't know that, Steve.
Yeah,
thank you.
It was a very conservative strategy, the spider strategy.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Lil, speaking of these ETFs, when when Steve's analyzing or you're analyzing a regular company and you're looking at the P&L, you're looking at insider activity, you're looking at price earnings ratios. When you're looking at an exchange traded fund, if you want to get into an exchange traded fund in the emerging markets or really anywhere else, let's say you wanted to get into gold, what do you look at? What are you analyzing? If someone wants to analyze an ETF, what kind of information should they be looking at since they're looking at a basket of stocks instead of just a particular company?
Well, I would ask myself, what am I trying to do here? You know, that's probably should be your first question. What are you trying to do? What are you trying to accomplish? And, you probably should have a little bit of an understanding about index, because when you buy ETFs, they are tied to an index. And let's say, for example, the emerging market, you know, we always refer MSCI. Emerging Market Index, right.
Okay. What's the MSCI?
MSCI is the Morgan Stanley, is actually developed by Morgan Stanley Emerging Market Index. And they capture large and mid-cap, representing about 21 emerging market countries and about 819 constituents. And they cover approximately 85% of the free float adjusted market cap in each country.
Okay. Now, I know that there are a number of different exchange-traded funds or ETFs that can cover any different sector. I guess there are, what, like 3,000 at last count exchange-traded funds out there, at least as many funds as there are individual stocks. So oftentimes, what are the difference between, say, one energy thing, like say there's the iShares Global Energy Sector, and what's that, the difference between that and say the SPDR, which has its own energy sector fund?
Well, the SPDR would be more broad-based because you're really covering all 500 companies within the S&P 500 index. Where, let's say, for example, the IYE, I think there's the iShare product of the energy. They strictly cover just some of those energy companies that is within the index.
Okay, so there actually can be some differences in the holdings, or at least the percentages of holdings, inside exchange-traded funds that cover the same index.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, so as we move along talking about the ETFs here, how many should be in a what would be representative of good portfolio? Again, Lily, you're saying, what is it that I want to do here? But let's say we want to be in pharmaceuticals, we want to be in energy, we want to be in industrials. Can you put a portfolio together that's strictly ETFs?
I would defer that question to Steve because he is the expert in portfolio construction.
Oh, God, there you go. You called him an expert. Now I got
to
go with this.
And that's why my name is first. Thank you very much.
I get historically, you know, if you have
no living with him now. All right, Steve, do you have portfolios that are strictly ETFs?
Right, because really, you know, it's the allocation, you know, the person that help you with the allocation, the asset allocation process that makes the difference between a good portfolio or mediocre portfolio.
Yeah, well, look, you know, and with an exchange-traded fund-based portfolio, you tend to be passive in origin. You can go ahead and have active management of your equity positions if you use a manager. Or you can go ahead and you can create a hybrid. That means using both individual equity positions and exchange-traded funds to go ahead and make up a portfolio.
Mm-hmm. What we're going to do is we're going to come up on the bottom of the hour break here, and then we'll put this ETF discussion to bed on the other side of the half hour and get into some economic issues. So right now, we're going to turn it over to TalkZone in Chicago for the break. You're listening to Money at Work from OB Capital. Brian Bourdon, Steve Memory, Lily Poy.
And now, more of Money at Work on TalkZone.com. Here's Steve Memory and Brian Bourdon.
Thank you.
That's right. Make sure you get the expert name in first.
Right. We did that. First order of business. Who's the genius here? It's Steve Memory and Brian Bourdon. We're back here for the second half hour of our program today. Brian Bourdon with you here. Steve Memory and Lily Poy are joining us here. And we've been talking about, we started off talking about emerging markets, and then we kind of segued into exchange traded funds, commonly known as ETFs. We're talking about how they're put together, how they're traded. And Lily, as we went to break, we were kind of touching on how they're managed. You know, we talked about passive management, and that can kind of seem somewhat innocuous, as if nobody's minding the store. But before we get off of ETFs here and move into some economic discussion, tell me what we were discussing this at the break. Go ahead and kind of get into what you were talking about there.
I would say, you know, even though ETF is really great, I found that a lot of investors, you know, they really don't have the comprehensive knowledge to use ETFs. So I would say the best thing for them to do is to consult the advisor. And you should, you know, as always, you should have a plan. You should have an asset allocation, you know, in place. And then you have your advisor help you select the different ETFs to construct your portfolio or to complete your portfolio. And while we're talking about emerging market earlier, and a lot of these emerging market have distributed really great dividends. And one thing about, you know, being involved with an ETF is you don't have to worry about those foreign tax and all that on your tax return. If as if you are buying a foreign stock, you know, on an individual basis.
Well, there's an advantage.
Right. Yeah. But you still capture the dividend.
Yeah. They'll still distribute a K-1 in some cases, though, too, right?
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, and as far as passive management goes, I don't want that to get – I don't want to hit that one too hard because, I mean, we use ETFs here.
But well,
Steve, if you've got something that's, you know, if you've got a sector that's underperforming, you're not just going to sit there and go, oh, well.
Well, the thing people have to keep in mind, and we say this to folks often, is that you can't just buy a passive investment and then go away. You know, any more than you would go ahead, get in your car, step on the gas, hit the cruise control, and then turn around and talk to people in the back seat. In both cases, something is going to happen down the road. Either the road will change or something will pull in front of you. And if you're not watching the road and you don't have your hands on the wheel, there's a very good chance you're going to end up in an accident.
You don't have to stop doing that, I guess.
Right. Yeah, because I often tell my father, you know, because one time I tried to explain to him what is an ETF, passive and active. So finally I said, Dad, I'm trying to be actively passive. and someone who's that active person, you know,
yeah,
need
well,
to
you
make
have
all
to,
the decisions for you.
There's got to be somebody driving the car,
right? Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, that's what it comes down to. I mean, really.
Okay, speaking of driving the car, our resident analyst here, our head analyst, Steve Memory, drives the car here at OV Capital. And admittedly, you know, I'm a passenger. The only time I get involved, if I think he's going to hit a tree, I'm going to tell him. In other words, you know, hey, I'm not sure we should buy this or sell that. And but, you know, our agreement is that he has the final word. And as such, he's the guy we're going to turn to get an idea of what is it that's going
Brian,
on here.
Don't sell yourself short. You're a great backseat driver.
That in mind, what's going on? I mean, we touched on the volatility earlier, and you had wanted to get into that and talk about how that's affecting markets and how it's affecting decision-making here at OV.
Well, sure. Look, we've had, you know, we had a nice run-up in 2013. What year are we in now?
Yeah, it's 2013.
This is 2014. I tell you, you know, I keep mentioning it. Here we are. We're already 1 month through the 2014 year, and I'm still talking about 2013. I mean, how can you not talk about it? We had a, you know, a great run up in the market. There were, you know, a lot of stocks that made money, a lot of portfolios made money, and it was a great all around feeling. But let's not forget there was a pullback halfway through that year as well. So these sorts of things happen. It's just right now we had our pullback is known as January, you know. So but that, we're taking a look at things. And as I mentioned beforehand, we see this nice ski slope of a chart where the market's gone ahead and had a distinct pullback. But the last few days, actually, are pretty nice. We went ahead and we had that 300-point plus down day on Monday, but that was followed with a positive day on Tuesday, and then Wednesday was down, but only slightly. Today we're up nicely, you know. And so the first thing that comes to folks' minds is, well, is that it? Have we hit the bottom? Is capitulation in play? Do I need to go ahead and start buying stocks? And this is something we have to go ahead and take a look at. And we want to go ahead and there's a couple of cases to be made. We'll make the case here, I guess, both for and against. And so just to go ahead and start off someplace, we'd like to start off with the bad news. Where are we in the marketplace right about now? Last I looked, we were up about 144 down from where we were at 150.
We've made some headway. The Dow's at 173 now.
Well, that's nice. Yeah. Got to like that.
You guys have to invite me back again because it seems like every Thursday when I talk, the market goes up.
Thursday's a good day.
Last Thursday went up.
Well, that's
Yeah, we had a nice recovery last Thursday, too. So we'll have Lillian next Thursday. So do your buying on Wednesday afternoon, everybody.
Yeah, excellent. There you go. But, okay, so let's take a look at the case, you know, that, that we've got more room to go on the downside, okay? The fact is that we've had a decline of about 5.7% today, notwithstanding. That's not figured in. But when we talk about a correction, something we haven't had in a good long while, what we look at in a full-blown correction is a pullback of around, well, of 10% or more. And really, by that way you look at it, we're only halfway there. You know, when we take a look at some of the technical data on the economic side, when we're looking at the long-term view, that is from a larger distance away, yeah, we had a bounce off the bottom of our trading range, but we blew through 1775 as a support level pretty easily. And from a technical perspective on the long view, our next support level would be all the way down at 1610. And that's a substantial, difference. It's a long way to go. Okay. So then you take a look at some of the fundamental numbers. Our continuing unemployment numbers, those people that are still on the unemployment rolls, rose 15,000. So that gave us, what, 2,964,000 people remaining unemployed as of the week ending January 25th. That's kind of some lousy numbers out there. Then you go ahead and take a look at the PMI that came out for January. January registered 51.3%, which is a decrease of about 5.2% from December. Those are seasonally adjusted numbers. December was at 56.5%, so that's substantial. New orders index registered 51.2%, which was a decrease of 13.2% from December's seasonally adjusted numbers. We take a look at the production index. We were at 54.8%, a decrease of 6.9%. Then we go ahead and take a look at the inventories of raw materials, decreased by 3 percentage points. That's the lowest it's been since December of 2012. So, you know, all of this sentiment gets to kind of weigh on you after a number. If you're just taking a look at these numbers, you go, oh, man, everything's down. Everything's down. We added unemployment. We, you know, are losing out on the production end of things. Everybody kind of has this feeling that the economy may be limping along, but we're accent on the limping right now. And that's what gave us this past pullback. We had a nice return in the marketplace, but the Fed has gone ahead and instituted tapering, so we're not going to have the easy money that's out there anymore. Maybe it's time to go ahead and pull back. And that's essentially the case for a full-blown correction. And it's a substantial one. But when we take a look at the case that we've made at least a short-term bottom, okay, the fact is that we did have a 5.7% decline. That's not insubstantial, okay? When we take a look at the technicals on a nearer term basis, get a closer look at everything, we say, yeah, we bounced off our 1740 support level. Major support is at 1730, and that's also the bottom of our trading range. So that's pretty solid. That gives us a little bit of solid footing. Jobs numbers just came out, 331,000 initial claims. That's against an expected 335,000. Okay, that's seasonally adjusted. But that's a positive indication coming out. We have Friday's numbers that are coming out. We expect to add 189,000 jobs this past month, which is better than the 74,000 jobs we had in December. So essentially we have unemployment continuing to decline. The overall economy grew for its 56th consecutive month, so that is a good sign that the economy is headed in the right direction. We had 18 sectors of the manufacturing index, okay, 18 industries there that were of those 18 industries, rather, 11 of them were growing in January, okay? So that's good news. When we took a look at the PMI report to come down through, we have to go ahead and take a look at the analysis of it, not just the numbers. And in the analysis, most of the panel that went through and put these numbers together cited adverse weather conditions as a factor. So most of the negative impact that we saw on businesses in January came from things that were outside a business environment. And most of the comments they had reflected optimism. You know, so we have the early stages of 2014. It seems like things are going to be moving in a good direction. So we got two good cases to be made. What does that mean? Well, what it means is, look, we've had a pullback. This is part of a correction, not a collapse. Okay. We have not, and we do not recommend pulling out of stocks or dumping stocks. What we're looking at is this solidification of support levels. Really is, it gives us an opportunity for selective purchases. That's not to say that we're going to go ahead and jump back in with both feet. This isn't, hey, pound the table, happy days are here again, and go ahead, strike up the band type stuff. But it does mean that we have a good opportunity for some stocks that were possibly at or near their full valuation areas that have been brought down to size a little bit. And we're starting to get some good earnings numbers that are coming through as well. So that gives us a good opportunity to make some money. Now, 10% correction remains a possibility, you know, but the last couple of days help.
Lil, what are you seeing in the emerging markets? Are you seeing anything like that? Are you encouraged by emerging markets? Is it a good time to get into the emerging markets? Is it a good time to hold? What are you seeing?
I always tell people you should never time the market, because if you just base on your investment strategy on a short-term trend, you know, you're probably not going to do very well. But you should always invest for the long term and then take any weakness in the market to build the position that you had originally wanted to have.
Well said.
Last year, you know, I thought about, you know, our market really had done well, 30%. I think it's really, really above and beyond expectations. But at the expense of gold, emerging market, real estate investment trust, and bonds. Right, Steve?
Sure, absolutely, which is why you have to go ahead and pay attention to stuff and make sure you're in the right place at the right time.
Well, there's a lot in play there. And when we come back for our final segment, what we're going to do is we're going to apply this to one of the companies we have been buying, have been watching. Steve's going to give you a little bit of information on that. So stay tuned, find out which one that is on the other side of the break. You're listening to Money at Work, OV Capital Management through TalkZone.com.
You're listening to Money at Work on TalkZone.com. Back to Steve Memory and Brian Bourdon.
All right, welcome back to Money at Work. This is our last segment for February 6th. We've talked about emerging markets today. We've talked about ETFs. We've talked about what's going on in the markets and the economy with the unemployment rate, how it's affected the indices, and you know, the fact that is it the right time to buy? Should we be selling? Are we going to see more of a downside? And I think, Steve, you're making the argument before the break that actually, you know, there's no reason to look at this as a time to really lighten up and throw out the baby with the bathwater. And what I'd like you to do is kind of in microcosm here, use one of the investments that we have here, one of the equity buys that we have that we've been holding on to here to kind of illustrate what you've been talking about here.
Absolutely. Well, Disney came out with their earnings yesterday after the close, and we got some good news. But the idea about Disney is at this point in time to yesterday, they had pulled back to about the $70 mark. And what that actually means is that the valuation of Disney had gone ahead, climbed up to about 75, had gone and then pulled back and made it a little bit of a better value even before earnings came out. We had been recommending Disney in the 60s. We picked them up as part of our portfolio, and Disney is and continues to be one of the companies that we have as part of portfolios here at OB Capital. Most of the clients that we had picked it up at about the $69 mark, thereabout. But one of the things that we see in a pullback like this is that for the month of January, Disney had actually pulled back about 6%. Now, that's kind of, you know, you sit there and you say, well, gee, that's a great buy. You went ahead and bought it, and then it pulled back about 6%. But the point being, when you buy it, you have to make sure that you have a valuation in mind. And when it becomes a reasonable value, that being that there is a significant amount of upside to the amount of downside risk you're taking, that's when you want to go ahead and make a purchase. Now, Disney came out, and in their earnings, they had their CEO actually was almost giddy on the call. But he came out and then and announced that they had a 33% increase in profits. And that'll make anybody happy, I guess. They had record theme park attendance for the past year. One of the things we had been talking about with Disney, one of the reasons we've been recommending it, is they had made a couple of key acquisitions, one of which was the Lucasfilm, Star Wars, and another was they had purchased Marvel Entertainment. So they brought Darth Vader and Thor together and partnered them up with Iron Man, and you've got a formidable entertainment industry basket of quiver or whatever you want to say, arrows in your quiver.
Let's just call it Geektopia.
Okay, yeah, all right. I know, I'm getting giddy. But the point is that because of this, you take a look at the Disney consumer products, you know, the stuffed animals, the Mickey dolls, right? Well, now they add to Mickey dolls the Princess Leia doll and the Darth Vader doll. Well, not actually dolls, but various and sundry
action figures.
Exactly. So they see a 24% rise in the profitability of the Disney consumer products, specifically attributable to the Star Wars toys. And that's pretty substantial. Talk about accretive, right? So then you go ahead and you follow that up with they had the new Thor movie this past year. And the Thor movie under Disney had a 36% higher revenue than the first Thor movie did. Okay. So they've got a little bit of a golden touch thing going on. Then out of nowhere comes this movie Frozen, which went ahead and made a boatload of money for him. And I love this quote. This is Robert Iger, the chairman of Disney. He says, I love these words, expect real impact to the bottom line for a while. When somebody says that at Disney, okay, you know that what they've got is something that's a franchise player, essentially.
Yeah, because that's something that, that's a fairly conservative company, Disney. But yeah. Thor, basically you give Fabio a hammer and you make a ton of money with it. The other thing is, you were talking about, and this is one of the things that struck me, is one of kind of the hidden valuation in the increased earnings. The increase in theme park attendance.
Absolutely.
That's great, but you've got to figure that only happens. I mean, that's got to be the sign of a somewhat recovering or almost burgeoning economy. If people are spending their money now, they feel like they have money to spend at theme parks. Yeah. That's kind of, if you're kind of analyzing, should I be in the market, should I not, what's going to happen in the time ahead? These are things you want to look for. When you read about things like this, you got to file this away in the pro side of the column here, because that is very favorable. That invites an expanding economy.
Absolutely. And the nice thing for Disney is, of course, people are actually coming to Disney and not just going to some random other theme park that are out there. They put a lot of money into the theme park recently. They've gone ahead and renovated a lot of things, you know. And I tell you what, I went when I was in college. I went a number of times when I was a kid down to Disney World. And went when I was in college, and you're going through the 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, and you see the wire that holds the submarine underneath there, and it's covered in, you know, you're not supposed to see the wire. What you see is a bunch of seaweed attached to it. You know, all that sort of stuff they've gone ahead and kind of cleaned up. Now, I don't know if you noticed or not, but they're also running commercials that we haven't seen in a while on the Seahawks having won the Super Bowl. The guy who had that interception, the name eludes me right now, but he had that interception for a touchdown. They're running the I'm going to Disney World commercials. Okay, so there's a lot of promotion out there. Look, the net result of all this is that they came out with earnings per share of $1.04, and the expectation was for 91 cents. Okay, that's an earnings surprise of 14.29%. That's substantial. Okay, now we were looking at the price, and when I last checked it, we were up about 5.25 since that's 5.25%, mind you, since they had reported. Okay, but the PE on Disney to this point in time through yesterday had been 21, which was comparable to its peers. Okay, so when you take a look at a pullback on Disney to around that $70 a share area, with a price earnings comparable to its peers, and it comes out with significantly increased earnings, okay, with the possibility of increased earnings in the future, that's the kind of thing you're looking for. So when we take a look at it, And last I checked, we were up around, 75, 64. Do you know where we stand right now?
Yeah, it's right now it's at 75, 45. It's still okay. Up well over 5%.
Exactly.
Since reporting.
Right. Okay. And it has a 1% dividend, but we're looking for about $96 on the stock. And it could be even higher than that, depending upon how these earnings translate and continue. Okay. So, that gives us 25% upside from where we're looking at. Okay. The risk is, our support at 69, and that's about a 9% downside. 25% upside to 9% downside is a good risk that I'm willing to go ahead and take. So we recommend the stock. We initiated purchases in our portfolios at 69, still a good buy here at almost 76.
Okay, great. That's what I was after. Is this still a good entry point? And you just answered that question.
Absolutely. I think Disney's one of those stocks that's out there that's going to be good for a long time.
Did you know that there's a Disney resort in Hong Kong, and also there's a Disneyland in Shanghai scheduled to be open in December 2015?
Did not know that.
How are they getting on all the rides there?
I did know that there's of course Euro Disney, and when we were over in France at the end of December, there was some talk about whether we wanted to go to Euro Disney. I just thought, you come all the way to France to go to Disney World. I just assume go to Florida or California. Quite frankly, it's substantially cheaper. But
they're a heck of a lot nicer.
Yeah, but you can't get a good beignet.
let's start to wrap it up here a little bit. We talked about Disney, and that's kind of our and again, you want to check with your own advisor before you take any of our suggestions here.
Disney's considered, I guess, a large cap growth company. They are in the consumer discretionary sector.
That means more than $10 billion, okay, for all you folks at home. It's a more than a $10 billion capitalization company. So what we're going to do here is we are going to take this opportunity to thank you all for joining us. I want to thank Lily. Lily Poy, thank you for joining us today.
Oh, I want to thank you for inviting me. I guess I should add one more. Earlier you asked me if everybody should have emerging market in their portfolio, and I'm going to go out on a limb, and I'm going to say yes, they should, have a percentage of their portfolio dedicated to emerging market, the appropriate ETFs.
Right. And again, you're going to check with your advisor on that and figure out where you should be. But until next week, I'm Brian Bourdon. That was Lily Poy. We've been joined by Steve Memory, our resident genius here at OV Capital. We'll be back next Thursday at 2:00 right here on TalkZone.com. You've been listening to Money at Work with OV Capital.